Get ready for poems for people who hate poetry.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Sunday Morning Poetry, which is a small little segment of poems for people who hate poetry. And we're going to be exploring this idea that I've been going over with the last three Sundays. This is the fourth Sunday that I've done this. You can find this at, go to iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play and just type in poems for people who hate poetry. And what we're going to be talking about today is the power of the human spirit. One component of the humanist project that we've been exploring in these poetry poems that asks the question of, you know, how can we have a secular, a atheistic, individualistic church, and not a church in the traditional sense, but just a spiritual font. And we'll talk a little bit about that kind of fountain that we want to be looking for. Now, one of the things that has been inspiring and kind of connecting all of the poems we've discussed so far, and I'll kind of go into those poems. And the poem we're going to talk about today is Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. But one of the connectors of all of this is, the quote that I've been reading from Ayn Rand. And let me read this quote. I'm going to pull something up on my phone for a second, so bear with me. But this quote is about religion's monopoly. And I've read this every time, but I want to continue reading it because I think it's going to be helpful in our understanding of what we're trying to accomplish. Again, Ayn Rand is an atheist. This is in the preface to the 25th anniversary of The Fountainhead, which is my favorite of all of Ayn Rand's books because of this. You know, oddly enough, someone, a good friend of mine, a while back once called me an atheistic preacher. And I don't know if that's a good thing. Maybe I was too preachy. But there is something that I'm personally interested in with these deep emotions that we are capable of, these what could only be considered in today's context or in a religious context as religious emotions of sacredness, of reverence, worship, things like that. But I think that that hijacking by religion, or that monopoly that religion has had for millennia, needs to be broken, and we need to break it. So here's what Ayn Rand had to say about this exact concept and what connects all of these poems. And she said, religion's monopoly in the field of ethics has made it extremely difficult to communicate the emotional meaning and connotations of a rational view of life. Just as religion has preempted the field of ethics, turning morality against man, so it has usurped the highest moral concepts of our language, placing them outside this earth and beyond man's reach. Exaltation is usually taken to mean an emotional state evoked by contemplating the supernatural. Worship means the emotional experience of loyalty and dedication to something higher than man. Just to stop there, one of the reasons I'm so obsessed with the Greeks is because that's true of them in a certain sense, but in another sense, it's not true of them. In another sense, it's something that they were different about, that they were the first ones to really have man or gods created in their image. All the gods before them were animalistic gods or creatures with eyes all around their heads and such. Like, they didn't look exactly like humans, but Greeks were the first one to make man the measure of all things. That was the famous Greek saying, man is the measure of all things, and they meant the human. And so this is the project that I think was hijacked by the Christians and by the thinkers who created a monotheistic world. And they've, you know, now gotten something, they've transcended instead of the natural world that we live in. They've absconded from that and went into the supernatural world, outside of the natural world. Okay. Worship means the emotional experience of loyalty and dedication to something higher than it. Reverence, I'm continuing the quote, reverence means the emotions of a sacred respect. Oops. To be experienced on one's knees. Sacred means superior to and not to be touched by any concerns of man or of this earth. But such concepts do name actual emotions, even though no supernatural dimension exists. And these emotions are experienced as uplifting or ennobling without the self-abasement required by religious definitions. So that's kind of our exploration. And the book, The Fountainhead, does a wonderful job of that with Howard Roark when Ayn Rand describes the feelings that Roark has towards building and his ability to manipulate the universe around him. She's doing it in religious terms. She's doing it in a religious way. And that, I think, is not a coincidence, and it's very important. Now, there's something I wanted to get to, a couple ideas before we get into Ulysses. So first, have some coffee. So there is a really interesting idea here in this religious things we can learn from religion. And there are things that what's really interesting about self-development books, self-help books, courses on making yourself a better person, is most of them stress the importance of affirmations. And I think that affirmations, or what religious folk would call prayers, are actually very useful for a human being. If you think about what we are as humans in terms of our language, the sounds and words, like they go together, words, sounds, and meaning. And part of the reason that we used to chant and have, prayers, or I should say not prayers, but had, a sense of importance to the words that we had, that we have. Part of what we're trying to get at is the repetitiveness, the importance of almost, ingraining into your head certain values that you hold. So let me give you a couple of examples here. So here's a religious example. Anybody who's been to a Christian church, Catholic church, I don't know if they do it in Catholic church, but most Christian churches that I've been to say this prayer in, I think it's Matthew 6:9-13. That's what it says. And it's basically, it goes, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." Now, what is happening here? This is a powerful poem. We tend to forget that the Bible is literature, and literature, can be have a form of poetry. And I've talked about what poetry is, and sometimes there's not a lot of, acceptance on what that is. But the Bible definitely has a lot of really good poetic statements. And part of poetry is a combination of sound and meaning. And this chant by Christians is a very powerful one. And we know that, Judaism, they have morning prayers, and they have other types of prayers. Similarly, when they go to, their synagogue, they have prayers. And when Muslims, pray five times a day to Mecca, and they have that in common with each other, no matter where they are in the world. And so there's a couple of things I think that's going on. And psychologists, I believe, have proven this kind of thing, is that when you think about the Pledge of Allegiance, when you pledge something, when you reaffirm a certain statement, it gains a certain kind of power in your mind. If you do this on a daily basis, and you do this, in public, we know this is a very powerful psychological tool, is this idea of commitment and consistency, especially in public. So I wrote an article on this recently, and it's based on a story from when the Chinese brainwashed some Americans during the Korean War. It's called She Now, HSINAO, She Now. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But the idea is, it's called the washing of the brain. And that's where we get our term brainwash from. And the idea was that they wanted to, the Chinese who are, working with the Koreans, wanted to find out if there was a way, and, some of the things they've been learning about the human mind, to take an enemy, an American patriot, and turn him into a turncoat. And they succeeded with a variety, with a, several men eventually wanted to stay in Korea, even though they went there to fight. And these were men that were supposedly patriots. Now, how did they do this? How did the Chinese accomplish this? They didn't torture them. They didn't beat them. It wasn't, you know, some kind of weird scene from, I can't remember the Orange movie, or the Orange Book. Oh man. I can't remember the name of the book right now. Something about orange. Oh man. That'd be crazy. Anyway, if anybody remembers, please put it in the comments. But the idea, and there's a book where this kid goes crazy, he gets brainwashed, and I'm just blanking on the name, the title. But in this book, and it, you know, there's this idea of brainwashing where they just flick on screens. They put some, you know, drops in his eyes and they torture him a little bit. And that's somehow supposed to, you know, make him into a calm citizen. But the Chinese didn't do any kind of, torture scenes like this. They didn't do anything like that. They didn't try to put a whole bunch of images in front of them and just, you know, hammer it in harder and harder. That's kind of what they did in 1984 is a lot of, in the book 1984 is a lot of torture and trying to convince you that 2 + 2 = 5 because I said so. Like that was the whole point of all the torture that they did for in that book. And, but that's not what they actually did. And that's not, proven to be very effective in terms of brainwashing, in terms of convincing somebody that they will now hold your ideas. What actually worked was commitment and consistency. The idea of, especially in public, the idea of slowly starting small and building little by little to get the POWs, the American POWs in China, to start making small little capitulations on what they believed. And it would be something as small, it would start off as something as small as America is not perfect. That's it. And then they would, you know, ask the Chinese interrogators would ask them to, you know, say, is America perfect? And say, well, I guess not. And say, you know, neither is China, neither is Korea. So, you know, no, none of them are perfect. So then they get them to commit to that idea. And then they would say, okay, well, why don't you, you know, would you mind or is it too much? Is it too crazy for you to just write down a couple things or tell me a couple things that you don't think is perfect about it? And then, you know, for the sake of argument, they just kind of said, well, you know, there's Wall Street or cronyism and blah, blah, blah. There's a couple problems. And, you know, again, it's not like China or Korea is perfect either. So it's very reasonable. And then the Chinese interrogators would have them write it down. And then they would get into a group and they would hand, you know, the notes back to the prisoner and say, would you mind reading what you said? And then the prisoner would say, okay. And he would read out loud, well, you know, America's, I love America. It's the most, you know, greatest country on earth. I would fight and die for America, but it's not perfect. I mean, there's a couple things wrong with it. And then they have committed in public to this idea that they're not, that America's not perfect. So then they internally believe that. This is a very powerful thing. The next thing that they would do is they would do something like an essay contest. And they would say, anybody can win this essay contest. Anybody. And they were, the Chinese were honest about that. Anybody could win. And they didn't, the genius part is they didn't give a huge amount of incentives. They didn't say like you'd be set free or you'd have unlimited access to the, you know, mailing. They just said you'd win 5 cigarettes. Because what the Chinese wanted to do is that they wanted someone to write the essay, but they wanted to them to write the essay mostly for their own motivations and purposes, and that the cigarettes they would give away 5 cigarettes. That's it to these prisoners, which is just enough to get them interested in doing it. But it's really they know that they wrote the essay, and the essay, you know, had something to do with you know, what is the superior form of government? All viewpoints can win, and they meant it. And so what tended to happen was these POWs would write this essay. And they would talk about how amazing the American system is, how it's better. But because they had already talked about it, they had capitulated a couple of key points. And they would put in, well, there's cronyism, there's XYZ. And so they started to, little by little, you know, put into writing. And then they would read their essays out loud to each other and, you know, to the rest of the prisoners and the Chinese. And so this kind of thing, what it slowly did was it told, showed them, that, well, maybe it's just a different system. Maybe it's not so evil. Maybe communism is, you know, good for Chinese, and the capitalist system is good for the Americans. And now what they've done, the Chinese interrogators, is they've implanted in the mind of the POWs a reluctance to resist more arguments. So as the Chinese, you know, now this person's more open to hearing because they've already committed and they want to stay consistent with what they've said to the idea that maybe America's not perfect. Maybe it's just, you know, to each his own. Now, what is the point of all that? The point of all that is the huge psychological power of commitment and consistency, and particularly of saying out loud and in public certain affirmations, prayers, phrases, you know, communal connections. You see this when you get to cults. You know, one of the things that a cult will do, like Jonestown, is they will isolate their members. So you cannot talk to people in the outside world. That's very critical. Mormons do this on a lesser basis. I remember when I had a friend that was a Mormon, they were not allowed to hang out with me very much. Although they could sometimes, but there were certain restrictions on what they could do and could not do. You see this with Scientologists, and it, with extreme cults, this is very extreme, as you can't do this. You can't date outside of it. You can't have too many friends outside of the cult. And Jones, you know, the Jonestown thing was they actually got to a point, blanking on the name of the preacher, but the preacher got to the point, as he was doing this cult over and over again and learning, he got to the point where he discovered that what would tend to happen is they would be in San Francisco, and a person would come to the cult from outside, or come to the church from outside of their cult, and they would drag the person away and say, "You're not going here, you know, Amy, you can't be here anymore. I'm your father. Forget these crazies." And then it would kind of, it would be like a bug in the mind of everybody else. And they're like, well, if she can go, maybe it isn't a good thing. Maybe we're not doing the right thing in this kind of belief. And so they would, you know, leave, and then people would break apart, and then it would, you know, have infighting, and then eventually the cult would fall apart. So just a little teeny pinprick from the outside world shattered the whole thing. So what the preacher of Jonestown, again, I'm forgetting his name, would do is he took them from San Francisco, where they started most of his churches, and he went to another country. And he went to this like little tropical paradise that he, you know, got some money for and bought up, and they created Jonestown. Now, in this Jonestown, the brilliance of this preacher is that he isolated them from everyone else. They were isolated from everyone. So this allowed him a certain amount of control. But one of the things that is really interesting about this is, like all communities, like churches, like anything, there were certain rules that they would read out loud to each other. You know, the community as all would be one of them. You know, no outsiders would be another one. And the point is that they would affirm that, and it would rise to their, and it was the using of the power of words. Throughout history, words have had the view of, you know, being in line with incantation. You know, this is why we think to this day, and like now it's not so magical, but we have fantasy books and games where, you know, the magicians or the wizards will have magical incantation. These are languages, words. If you know, Lord of the Rings, when they go to a mountain pass and they have to read out loud certain words, because there's always been this view, and it's because it's true, that words have a certain amount of power, that they're strong, that they do something wonderful, and that they can be, you know, used for good or bad, but that they have a psychological power. I mean, if you think about men go to war for words, men murder for words, men die for words. It's really just words. Now, the words may represent something, but when a leader is up on a hilltop preaching down to you and telling you to do a certain thing, those are words that they're using. Those are sounds coming from their throats, vibrating from their throats and spitting out of the world, just like I am now spitting out to whoever's listening to this. That's words, and that's the power of words. So we have this really powerful thing of affirmations. And, you know, I read the Lord's Prayer, and that is a powerful, powerful poem. It's a poem. Now, they call it a prayer, and that's fine. It's a prayer. You know, it's, you put your hands together, you pray, you ask for, you affirm to your God your viewpoints. And there's a lot that's packed into this little Our Father in Heaven, hallowed be your name. And they're saying something important to themselves. But what's important is that they say it regularly. That's a critical part of why they've succeeded. And part of it's because of the beauty of the language, and part of it's, you know, because they really believe it, and part of why they believe it is because they say it so much. And this is the role of affirmations. This is why in every self-help book, every, you know, self-development course, everything about self-help in general, it's Think and Grow Rich or Dale Carnegie, is they'll tell you to say that, you know, what your mission is all the time, or to say, you know, in Napoleon Hill's words, what is your definite purpose? So if it's something like, I'm going to make $1 million this year. You know, you're supposed to put that on your mirror that you, while you're brushing your teeth, and you look at it and you think about it, and you focus on it, and you say it every day. And it's because, and there is something to this psychologically. We've proven this in sales. We've proven that if you take a group of salespeople and you take an equal group of salespeople, a separate group of salespeople that are equal talent, and you give them two different tasks. One, to simply have in their heads and their hearts a goal that they want to go, and they go out. And another one, that write down their goals and tell it to everybody else. The ones who write it down and tell it to everybody else will win 10 times out of 10. They will always kick everyone's butt. And I've experienced this personally because, you know, when I was in Cutco, I would say something like, I want to sell $1,000 this weekend or this week, let's say. And say something small, like $1,000 this week. That's a good goal for back then when you're like 19, 20 years old. Now, if I tell everyone that, I write it down, I have it in my book that's with me all day, every day. What tends to happen is, you know, by Tuesday, Wednesday, you're at like $100, $250. You know, it's a slower than normal week. And then you go into Friday and you're only at like $300. You haven't been able to get anything else. But you have two choices. You can give up or you can keep going. Now, what a lot of people will do, because they have made this public and they feel accountable to everybody and they feel accountable to themselves, is that they will push harder into the weekend. They'll go farther. They'll do more into the weekend because, they want to make sure that they are, they're doing their best, because they have this goal that they've told everyone and they've written it out loud and they've told everyone about it. So, you know, they push and push, and let's say Saturday comes by and they're only at like 500. So they're halfway through their goal. They have one day and they just push and push. And what happens a lot is that it almost feels like magic. Like the last, and this has happened to me more than once. So it feels like magic. Like the last one or two demos of Sunday night, that we do in a sales presentation, and you all of a sudden sell $700 or $1,000. Like, it's happened more than once where you sell, you know, this big old set all of a sudden right at the last minute. And it's like, boom, I got it. Right. And it feels like the secret. Like, it feels magical. But really what it is that you had something psychologically to push yourself so that you would not surrender. And that's part of the role of affirmations, you know, in this, that's the power of this affirmation. And we have like this Our Father in Heaven. This is Christians coming together and reading something together that brings them together, and that shows that they are part of the group, that they are, you know, at one with everybody, that they believe what everybody else believes. And it then ingrains that belief deeper into their own soul or psyche. So there's a power to words, and it's not irrelevant at all. And Christians definitely, and I should say religious people in general, really, really, really understand this. And one of the reasons why I think atheists or individualists or secularists or humanists don't have this same kind of power is because they don't respect words in the same way. They don't, you know, for a religious person, there is a religious connotation. There is this idea that God has put it there. It's, you know, a powerful reverence. But this is the Ayn Rand thing I was telling about. It's like these emotions of reverence are actually true, in that they are explaining or trying to represent a certain doctrine or a certain emotional feeling. So affirmations are very powerful. And Ulysses, what we'll talk about in a few minutes, and the poems that I've been reading are good affirmations to have to some degree. And they tell you different things. You know, my criticism of many, but one of my criticisms of this, you know, religious prayer of Our Father is that they tend to have, you know, a certain set of these religious doctrine prayers, and that's it. And there's not really a questioning of it. There's not differing views that are really accepted on a strong level. And then, of course, there's the problem that it tends to refer to a supernatural entity that does not exist. That's a small problem there. There's no existence of a God. And so that makes it a kind of a challenge. But, of course, they don't think that. Of course, a religious person believes, at least on some level, that there is a religious deity up in space. So, okay, so the affirmations are powerful psychologically. And so they can be good. The right affirmations can be good. And just to give you an idea, fine. Ayn Rand has a quote. If I can find it, I don't know why I don't have this memorized, but here it is. It's the John Galt quote. And just went away. So it's basically, here's what he says. I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine. Now, this serves all the same purposes that the Our Father in Heaven serves in terms of language. Now, it's not as poetic as the Our Father in Heaven, actually, but it's shorter and it gets to the essence of everything. I think it's even more powerful in a sense because it gets to the essence of everything that Ayn Rand is trying to say. I swear. So it's a prayer, except it's a prayer, you know, it's more of a prayer that I think relies on yourself versus another person because you're swearing. Now you could swear it to the public, the community, but you're really swearing it to yourself. Like, I swear not to lie anymore. I swear not to eat cake. Well, you're really saying that to yourself. So there's a more of a focus on the self in this, which makes sense for Ayn Rand versus, you know, in Our Father in Heaven, you're speaking to an Our Father. You're speaking to somebody who's outside of yourself. Who is this outside? Well, it's some kind of deity in space, right? It's like a munchkin up floating up there somewhere. I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine. It's a very simple statement, but this is the cohesive statement. So this is the other part. So of this is that it's communal, even in Ayn Rand's individualistic Galt's Gulch. So in the religious version, it serves the purpose of affirmations, serve the purpose of psychologically making your values powerful to you. And that's one of the powers of an affirmation, whether it's, I'm going to make $1 million this year, or looking in the mirror and saying, I'm a good person and people like you, or you're a good person and people like you. Like that kind of cheesy self-help thing, which I think is counterproductive in a lot of ways. But my point is that the reason this is so stressed by motivational gurus, by religious leaders, by cult leaders, and even by Ayn Rand, the arch individualist and atheist, the reason this is so powerful is because words are powerful. It rises, you know, from your subconscious to the top of your tippy top of your, you know, neocortex conscious mind. It gives you a strong representation of your values, and it makes you feel more powerful, and you know, and it makes you understand it and have a deeper conviction. Gives you more conviction. So that's one of the things. Now, the other thing is the communal aspect of it. So even in Ayn Rand's arch individualistic, humanistic, atheistic world, they have a prayer. And that prayer is the I swear on my life, I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man nor ask another man to live for mine. Now, notice it doesn't say anything about helping. It's about living. And there's a stressing on that. But the point is that when these titans, these atlases in Atlas Shrugged, get together. They want to live in a community of individualists. And this is how they do it. It's the idea that I'm going to live for my life. You live for your life. We can come together. We can trade. We can ask each other for help if it's necessary. But I'm not going to live for you. I'm not going to breathe for you. I'm not going to, you know, work for you. Like, you're going to have to work yourself. And there's a stress on that, which I think is very, very important. But it's still important because it's what affirms the communal value. So everyone is always knowledgeable of why they're there and what they believe in. And, you know, we do this with, for instance, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence is the most poetic political document in the history of the world, probably. And that's not a coincidence that it's not a law. It's the spirit of the law. The Declaration of Independence is the spirit. There's nothing in there that says you have to do this, that, you know, you have the freedom of press, for instance. That's in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. That's not in the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence is a political poem. And it's a political poem that unites a country for hundreds of years based on an idea. But it's words. And that's what I'm trying to stress with what's necessary for other elements, including the spiritual elements, is you need to have those words. You need to feel those words. That's an important part of your, that's an important part of your existence, and to have values that you actually believe in. And you need to use words to have those values and to represent those. But what it does for you is it psychologically affirms those values so that you act on them, you believe in them, you are convicted by them, you're willing to fight for them, you understand them, and you maybe even necessarily need to die for them. There are certain words that are worth dying for. The Declaration of Independence being one of them. And then it is a communal connection. So community is still important, even if you're an atheist. And what it does and what it's saying and what they're trying to get at is that you can, that this is an important thing to have, this communal thing, because it's why we're all here. So even an individualist can have a shared value of a whole bunch of individuals who swear by their own lives, but they get together because you want to trade, you want to live better, you don't want to live on a desert island. So there is value in the community, but insofar as it doesn't get into, you know, I'm going to infer in, or like interject into your life, you're going to interject into my life. If something happens, it's your duty to take care of me, and so on and so forth. Now, all of that is to set up and to kind of talk about, you know, the next poem in this series, Sunday Morning Poetry, which is Ulysses. So we've been talking about a humanist way of approaching spiritual values, a humanist, secular, atheistic way of approaching spiritual values, such as sacredness and reverence, and so on. One of the first poem that we did in here, excuse me, I don't know if coffee will help, but the first poem that we did in this series was called Sunday Morning. And one of the things that, and this is by Wallace Stevens, one of the things that he said was, the greatest poverty is not to live in a physical world. And this is the humanist project, is that, and to not be a complete materialist, but at the same time, to not be a complete spiritualist. So to understand the interplay between the two, when you look at a statue of David, well, that's a spiritual experience that you have, but not in a religious sense, not in a sense that is outside. Like, when I say religious, I'm using it as supernatural. By supernatural, I mean anything other than the physical world. So your emotion of feeling a sense of reverence that this, you know, person is standing there challenging a Goliath, and he's about to sling his little rock at this guy. That feeling that the statue evokes in you is not supernatural. It is natural. It is something that, but it does have the feeling of a religious connotation, because there is something, you know, because when we talk about religion, we have only the language of religion. We have no alternatives anymore. I do think that there were some alternatives in ancient times. They at least had, because they were obsessed with the physical world. That's why every, you know, they were naked all the time. They believed in the senses. Everything was about the perception of man. If you look at the Parthenon, it's designed exactly for the perception of man, where it looks, you know, small at one end and it gets bigger based on designed around perspective, because man is the measure of all things. This is what they were obsessed with, and everything they wanted to do. So on Sunday morning, we see the a world of senses as enough for, you know, that's all that you need. You just need the world of senses and you'd be happy human. So that's what Sunday morning is kind of about, is that we don't need a spiritual afterlife. There's something that I think informs all of these poems as well, and that's the idea that death is the mother of beauty. Excuse me. And you can say death is the mother of truth as well. Not in the same sense, but death is the mother of beauty is the idea that the fact that it's going to end, our lives are going to cut off, be done. There's no more. There's no afterlife. There's no immortality. There's no heaven. There's nothing that happens afterward, that there is a point in your life when it will be over. Now, you can, again, metaphorically reincarnate. You can metaphorically resurrect. You can metaphorically reinvent yourself, which is, I think, the proper way of thinking about resurrection, is that you get married. Well, you've resurrected as a married man or married woman versus, you know, just being who you were before. So it's a new version of yourself, which is a form of, you know, resurrection, death and rebirth kind of thing, which is represented in the ceremony a lot of times. Now, so that to me, I think, is the critical component here that we're talking about, is what is that secular, non-supernatural element? Death is the mother of beauty. That frames everything of our lives. So we look at things as beautiful because they're going to die. If they were immortal, they would not be beautiful. I mean, there would be no sense of beauty if there was no finiteness. I mean, if we lived in this land, and I touched on this on the first Sunday morning prayer poem / prayer called Sunday Morning by Wallace Stevens. If you literally lived in a land where nothing died, I mean, that you have to see that something, it would just be, it wouldn't have beauty. The concept of beauty would not apply, because when you see something that is going to die and it's going to wither, the way we understand beauty is that this is the moment in its cycle that it is the best. Same thing with a human. You know, I brought up some ancient Greeks that they thought a beautiful death was if you died unscarred. So if you just kind of drop dead at 20. You had this beautiful body, perfect, pristine, and not a scar on you. That was what they thought was ideal, is a beautiful death. Excuse me. And the reason that that was ideal is, one, because they had no separation between the afterlife and the life and the spirit and the body in the way that we do. They believed fundamentally that when you died, you as you died. So if you had your head cut off, you would die. You would go wandering through Hades with your head cut off. If you had your leg cut off, you'd go. That's what it means to have a spirit, mind, body, spirit, body, integration is, you know, you cut off your leg in the real world. Then if you died, you would go to Hades. So they did believe in a spirit afterlife, but in a, you know, they believed in it as one entity, like, unlike we do today. Today, you know, if you lose a leg, supposedly, like, I think the feeling is that you would go to heaven and be perfect. But the point is that the reason we have a concept of beauty is because we have a concept of death, because we know things are going to end. And, you know, if they were eternal, they would not be beautiful. I mean, you would just, everything would just be. It's very hard to explain the concept, I think, or at least I have a difficulty. But the idea is that just everything would be, there would be, because you would never see the progress and the trajectory that a life makes and that it can die. And therefore, there's a moment, you know, in your 20s, for instance, when you're a physical beauty, physical specimen, that's perfect. Okay. So Sunday Morning by Wallace Stevens really emphasizes the world of the senses as enough for the poet, that you don't need faith. You don't need supernatural world. You can just be dancing around naked and worshiping the actual sun in some kind of ancient ritual, and that would be enough. And he really stresses, you know, with the oranges and the coffees and the cuckoo, the bird is beautiful. multicolored bird and this beautiful woman in her peignoir, her nightgown, you know, just kind of relaxing on a Sunday morning. So Stevens is really stressing the senses in that first poem. In the second poem we did Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold, which has a much more downtrodden feel to it. And it's the idea that he still accepts the same idea that there's an impossibility of a supernatural faith. There's not going to be a faith in anything, that there's only what there is, but there is a kind of a wisdom out there that he talks about. And, but it's going to be a little bit more down in his, you know, it's a little sadder, tragic than Sunday Morning, which basically says, all we need is the senses. That's good. We can basically be pagans and touching each other and we'll be happy. And we can touch oranges and cockatoos. And if you look at the world properly in Sunday Morning, and I really like this, like the idea that if you look truly and you integrate, you know, look at the leaves of this, it's a beauty because I know it's going to die. It's not going to be there. That I am as beautiful today as I'm going to be for the rest of my life. That I'm not going to get more beautiful. I'm going to get less beautiful as I age. So this is the perfect time to live and to really appreciate what you have. Directive was the next one by Robert Frost. And this was a really intense one for me. And one of the key sources, the key images here was the brook that went around the metaphorical church that represented all the churches of human history and throughout and all the different religions. It doesn't matter what religion it is, all the thousands and thousands of religions throughout all the eons, he represented them as this little church or this little house that used to be, that is no longer a house. And the idea here is that you want to look for the brook that gave them their source. And that, I think, is what Ayn Rand is kind of talking about, is there's a source of all of these, and that's the inner emotion. That's what we all feel in common when we look at a great achievement that we all think is great. Like when the Apollo series launched, 1 million people went to watch that launch. It was a big deal. They all looked up in reverence at this thing. That is the feeling, but that is a secular, atheistic. There's nothing religious about it, although the Apollo program tried to make it religious, but it's not religious. It was an emotion that we all felt, and it was a secular emotion. It was because there's only a secular emotion. There's not actually anything else. Today, I wanted to go into the poem Ulysses. This covers, I think, a lot of the powerful affirmation that you need to live a good life. That, I think, is an important part of this particular poem because, how do we say this? Ulysses is a poem that is about a lot of things. It's about philosophy, about how to live. It's Ulysses is the is Odysseus, if you know the Iliad and the Odyssey. And remember in the story, I'm going to say Ulysses, just remember it's Odysseus. It's the same thing. It's just the Roman version of Odysseus. But Ulysses has fought the Trojan War alongside Achilles, the great Achilles, and Agamemnon, and Diomedes, and Ajax, the undefeatable and the powerful, you know, man who could not be beaten in battle. And all these great men, and he fought against great men like Hector and Paris, and he fought the great King Priam and all the princes of Troy. And it was this powerful 10-year war that was epic, and everybody, you know, became heroes because they fought the war. That's part of the point of the Iliad, is that you can't be a hero in the sense that they were without fighting that war. It's the great conflict that Achilles has. So this is Ulysses. And then after the war is fought, you know, Ulysses is the trickster who came up with the Trojan horse idea to put some Greeks in a Trojan horse, pretend like they all had left, and, you know, given that as a gift to the Trojans or to appease the god Poseidon so that they can go home. The Trojans take the horse in. Of course, there's a whole bunch of Greeks in the belly of the horse. They pop out at night, open the gates, and kill everybody in Troy and win the war. So that's Odysseus or Ulysses. And then they go home. But because of some of the sins of the wars and because of some of the sins of men like Agamemnon, who killed his daughter Iphigenia before embarking on the war. So they had to do that because the gods demanded it, or at least they said they did. So they demanded this, and Agamemnon killed his daughter in order to have a safe journey. But this, of course, cursed everything, and there was a lot of cursing going. So Ulysses tries to get home, but it takes him 10 years. He gets trapped on islands by Circe. He fights off, you know, beasts, and he fights off, you know, one-eyed monsters, cyclopses and such. And then he has to fight off the suitors who are trying to marry his wife, Penelope. So Ulysses has had this really strong life of adventure, and he's the king of Ithaca, but he hasn't really had that much time to be king as far as we know. I don't know the exact amount of time. I don't know if it's stressed or not, but you can imagine he left home at, you know, like in his early 20s or so with his young son and his young wife. And he's now in his 40s and he's coming home for the first time and he's fighting to get home in the Odyssey. And he finally makes it. He kills all the suitors. Sorry, spoiler alert, but you've had 2,000 years to read it. So sorry. And then he, you know, finally makes it back to his wife. He makes love to her and then they're happily ever after. But then what happens next? He's still, let's say he's 40 years old. Let's say he's 40 years old at this point, right? They got married young. So let's say he left at 20. He fought till he was 30 and then it took him 10 years to get home. Now he's lived a full life, but he's 40. So let's say but maybe he's 50 or 60. I mean, it doesn't really matter that much the exact date, but the thing to remember is that his life's not over. So now what? So here's this guy who's an adventurer his whole life. And now he's sitting around, now he has to do the things of a king. And we think of being a king as this exciting thing, but it often is not exciting. It's just, you know, being an arbiter of a lot of problems. People, that guy let his goat into my pastures and they were eating all my hens or something, right? And it's like, oh, and they're fighting over, that guy stole my pig or that guy slept with my wife. What are you going to do about it, King Odysseus, King Ulysses? And then he has to do go do this, or, you know, bring your wife to my chambers. I'll take care of her. No, just kidding. You know, so I'm sure there was some of that, but there's a lot of boredom to being a king, a lot of life piled on life, just doing the same things, repetition. Is, you're kind of a high level bureaucrat. And I can't imagine Donald Trump having that much fun anymore. I imagine it's a lot of boring. Here's a document to read this. It's like, oh, I'll just have my assistants do it, right? It's boring. It's not that exciting once you've done it for a year or two or three. It's maybe exciting at first, but then it's like the same stuff over and over again. You know, territorial disputes. Someone's crops are that's my territory, not his territory. Or I want him to marry my daughter and he said he would. Now he's reneging on it, blah, blah, blah. So that's a lot of, you know, so now we're at the end of Ulysses's life. And then, you know, the question is, what does he do now? And that's what this poem is about. And one of the reasons the poem is so powerful is because it's so encompassing. It encompasses everything and about a life, I think, every fundamental thing. And then it really represents the power of the human spirit. I think that's where it gets most of its power from, is that it's about moving on, even when it seems like there's no will or when there's nothing left. You know, your pure will and you're just like, scraping one step at a time. You're just crawling through one step at a time, one little arm pushed at a time. So I'm going to read this poem and I'll have it up on the screen here. There we go. So I'm going to read the poem with you. And if you're watching live, if you go to Facebook, you'll see I have, or on YouTube, I'll have this and I'll have the poem up. And we'll go through it. I'm going to read it. You're not going to understand a bloody word. That's not true. I'm sure you will understand it. One thing to keep in mind about this poem is that it's in free verse, so it's not rhymed. And there's a technical term called enjambment, which means that the thought does not necessarily end at the end of the line. So in other words, you know, it goes to the end of the line and it might move, spill over to the next line, the thought, or it often does. And, you know, we can talk about why if you're interested, but, you know, basically it's just a certain technique that you can use. Sometimes, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. See how it ends? Like it doesn't, you know, there's a continuation, of course, but it doesn't like, If it were to have our Father in, and then move over to the next line, heaven, hallowed be your name, that would be enjambment. Is if the line were to, or the thought were to kind of wrap around in the next line. Okay, let's go over. So I'm going to read this all the way through, and then we're going to do a converse with verse. Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. It little profits that an idle king, by this still hearth, among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race, that hoard and sleep and feed, and know not me. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that loved me and alone on shore. And when through scudding drifts the rainy Hyades vexed the dim sea, I am become a name. For always roaming with a hungry heart, much have I seen and known, cities of men and manners, climates, councils, governments, myself not least, but honored of them all, and drunk delight of battle with my peers far on the ringing plains of windy Troy. I am a part of all that I have met. Yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use. As though to breathe were life, life piled on life were all too little, and of one to me little remains. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence something more, a bringer of new things, and vile it were for some three suns to store and hoard myself and this gray spirit yearning in desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. This is my son, mine own Telemachus, to whom I leave the scepter and the isle. Well loved of me, discerning to fulfill this labor by slow prudence to make mild a rugged people, and through soft degrees subdue them to the useful and the good. Most blameless is he, centered in the sphere of common duties, decent not to fail in offices of tenderness, and pay meet adoration to my household gods when I am gone. He works his work, I mine. There lies the port, the vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark, broad seas. My mariners, souls that have toiled and wrought and fought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine, and opposed free hearts, free foreheads. You and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off! And sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. So that is the poem. Now let's do a little bit of a converse with verse, which if you've been following the podcast is where I go through, you know, a section by section and we kind of talk about it. We converse with the verse. We don't analyze it and, you know, express that this is what you have to think about it. We kind of discuss, you know, and if you're alone, like I'm alone, I can just converse with the poem. It's a conversation back and forth, thinking about it. So let's go through this. It little profits that an idle king by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. What the heck does that mean? What is he talking about here? Let me put this up a little bit bigger. So it's clear it little profits that an idle, so profits, he's not getting a lot out of this. And what is he not getting out of being an idle king? Now, one thing we don't know is who he's talking to or you know, even what's going on. We know the poem is called Ulysses, so we know that it's Ulysses talking. And I'm pretty sure that Tennyson actually named it Ulysses, but one of the advantages of reading something like this twice is that you kind of get a better view of it the second time around. But we know that this is Ulysses. This is the guy who's the archetypical adventurer. He's the greatest of all adventurers. And now he's just at home as an idle king. And the concretes he uses is he's by this still hearth. So it's not a moving hearth. It's not a fire out in the middle of a jungle when he's about to go fight off some, you know, wild beasts or some, you know, savages that are just trying to destroy them. Or he's going to go to battle with the Amazons and he's by this fire out there. Instead, he's by this still hearth, which is, you know, the fireplace among these barren crags. So, you know, these kind of dirt and rocks, basically, and just a rocky place that he lives in. And he's matched with an aged wife. Now, you know, that's kind of an insult, matched with an aged wife. But he's also just recognizing a fact that we all age, and his wife is aged. And he's also saying that maybe they've come to this point in their careers as married people where they've kind of just accepted each other as who they are. They know who they are. They have a certain kind of love, but it's not probably the same kind of love that you get as a newlywed, where there's so much fire and passion. You're just matched with an aged wife. But he doesn't stress the wife thing. He's not upset with her. You know, if you know the story of the Odyssey, he really loved her so much that he fought very hard to get back to her. He gave up Circe, the most beautiful, you know, one of the beautiful nymphs on her island, and he said, "No, I want to get back to my wife." Even though his wife by this point would have been in her, you know, mid to late 30s or 40s, like she was a little older. But you know, so there's one of the great things about the Odyssey is that there's a stressing of the love of her spirit, even though her body is aging and she's not going to be as beautiful as this ageless nymph Circe, and Ulysses or Odysseus is sad. He misses this person who had a soulful connection with them, to each other. So anyway, he in this section, you know, I think he's really saying that retirement sucks. You know, he's not exactly retired, but he's kind of retired. He's an idle king. I meet and dole unequal laws. Now, just a note, unequal in this sense just means variable. It doesn't mean unjust. It's not like he's saying that, you know, it's unequal between these two different parties. He's just saying that there's just meting out these varied, different laws to a savage race. So his people are kind of savages. And this is definitely an ancient view that I think to some degree is true. But I also think it's, now I think in the modern world, it's a kind of a scary thing to think of that President Trump is going to mate and dole out unequal laws. But we've come to a different, you know, by the time we get to the 20th century or the 1700s, when we get the Declaration of Independence, we have a completely different view of this, but that's another story for another time. But he's, you know, saying that this race of people, they're his people, and he's, you know, they're a savage race, that it's his duty to help them become less savage, to help them become civilized, which is part of what the ancient Greeks were obsessed about, was bringing order to chaos, bringing civilization to savages, which I think is a good thing overall. Civilization is a good, capital G, good. But this savage race to this king is they're hoarding and sleeping and feeding, and they don't even know who he is. And when he says, "No, not me," I don't think he means in the sense, "knows not me," as they don't know who their king is. I think they don't know who Ulysses is. And I think there's actually two layers of this poem, which I'll try to touch on as we go. But one of the things is that Tennyson, who's, remember, writing in the Victorian era, the 1800s, 19th century, and he's writing to an audience that knows Ulysses, that knows who Odysseus is, or Ulysses. But Ulysses is talking about that he, in his own time, is being forgotten. And I think in the 21st century, Ulysses is forgotten. Achilles is forgotten. We don't know them very well. I mean, we kind of hear the names. We don't really know what the heck the Iliad and Odyssey is really about. And it's not a coincidence. I mean, these things are not lightheartedly chosen as the greatest works of literature in the history of the human world. And so it's kind of a tragedy that they're going. And if you think about who is meeting and doling unequal laws, and who the savage race is, we are. If we forget who Ulysses is, we're the savage race. But he doesn't care. That's one of the great things that makes him a hero. It's he, a little prophet's that an idle king by this still harp, sits around basically. Now here's the next section, lines 6 through 11. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that loved me and alone on shore. And when through scudding drifts, the rainy Hyades vexed the dim sea. Now we get into the why he's idle and he's sad about, or his current existence. In the first couple lines, it was basically, I'm existing, I'm not living. Now he's saying, I'm living, I want to live, I don't want to just mere existence. If you think about existence, the idea of existence versus living is that if you merely exist, you're just kind of going through the routines. I think 90% of people, even people who travel the world, they party all the time, they're with new people, sexual partners all the time. I think they're merely existing. They're not living. And it's difficult to live. Living is not easy. If it were, then everybody would live. Breathing is easy. Living is hard. Okay. Now, what he is saying is, I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. So we see why it's, dull for him before. But I want to stress something here. I think this is important about poetry and reading poetry. When you look up words and you try to understand them, poetry is one of the best places to do this because great poets are masters of words, grand masters of words, great grand masters of words. Like, they understand words, and in one degree, they are a poet is one who is purifying the dialect of the tribe. So they're trying to continue on the dialect that we hold. The dialect that we hold. They're trying to save that to some degree, but they're also trying to expand that. I mean, most of the phrases, for instance, to love and loss is better to not have loved at all, something like that. That's a quote from a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson, In Memoriam. And he's talking about not a lover, actually, but his best friend, his absolute best friend, his soulmate, male friend. I don't know if Tennyson was gay or not, but it doesn't matter. But the point is that that's what he's talking about in that case. And the point is that phrases like that come from poetry. Most phrases, most of the words that we hold come from poetry. Poetry, preserves, purifies, and pushes forward the language that we use, whatever language that might be. If it's English, then English poets do that. If it's Italian, Italian poets do that. If it's French, French poets do that. That's one way you know something is poetry, by the way, which is why the things today that I see as poetry are not poetry very often. Okay, but here's an interesting statement. I cannot rest from travel, I will drink life to the lees. Now the lees, if you look this up, there's different versions of the lees, but it basically is the sediment that accrues at the bottom of a wine, wine bottle. So this used to be more prevalent back in the day, but you can see this a little bit in our own wine, but not nearly as much. When I've seen translations of this, this is one that really kind of bothers me. When I see translations of this, most translator, like if you go to Shmoop or YouTube, you know, translate, most poets, literary instructors or professors will say that it basically means live life to the fullest, which is true. But this is the power of poetry. You have to think about all, you know, the etymology of these things and how, you know, if you really want to get a lot out of a poem like this, think about what else it could mean, or think about the connotations, you know, the emotional spirit of what it means and the denotations. So one of the things about the bottom of, you know, the dregs, the lees, the bottom little barrel is that of the bottle is that that's the grossest, nastiest part of the wine. You know, if you drink wine or like if you drink anything, the top is going to be the best. The bottom is going to be the worst. Part of it is, you know, if you think about it, you know, if you're drinking like a soda and you share it with people, like let's say if six people share soda, I don't know why you would do this, but let's say you did. Well, if you got to the last bit of it, most of it's going to be backwash from the other five people, right? So the person who gets the last drink of that soda pop, they are going to be getting the backwash of five people. It's kind of gross, right? And, you know, that may not be the case exactly with the lees, but the idea of the lees is that it's this gross, gooky, thicker section of the bottom of a wine bottle that you wouldn't want to drink and that most people leave out. And so what Tennyson is stressing by using the concrete of life to the lees, it's not a Greek poet does not use any word lightly. Every word serves a very clear purpose in the overall poem. And here he's trying to say that this Ulysses character, who's an old king, is going to drink life to the last drop, no matter how nasty that last drop happens to be, because it's life. You know, remember that quote from Wallace Stevens, the greatest poverty is not to live in a physical world. And another way to think about this is Achilles in the Odyssey, the Homer's The Odyssey, says it's better to be a slave on earth than a king in hell. And what he's stressing, you know, when Odysseus meets the dead, now dead Achilles, Achilles says that he wishes he would have gone the other way and stayed on earth, because even a little bit of life is better than, you know, eternity in hell, even if you're the best among men in hell, or Hades in that case, which honestly didn't have quite the hellish connotations that hell has today. But that makes it even more, that stresses the point even more. To the Greeks, you know, afterlife was neither good nor bad, it just was. But what Achilles is saying is that it's better to live. It's better to be alive. Like anything is better to be alive. Like it's, you know, because you're in a physical world, and the physical world is the best world there is. The spiritual world is not a better world. That's how we in 2018 think of it, whether we're religious or not. When we think of the afterlife, we think of it as like this paradise, but Achilles is saying that it's not. It's, you know, devoid of all feeling. It's devoid of senses. It's devoid of physical touch, of sex, of kissing, of eating a nice chocolate pie. Like all of that is gone. We think it, you know, today that would exist in the afterlife. Of course, there is no afterlife, but it doesn't. Like the point is that the spiritual world, a supernatural world, is a world without the physical world, and it sucks. You don't want to live there. You don't want to be there. It's better to live here, you're 80 years, die, and that's it. Because this is the physical world. This is better. And Ulysses is going to drink life to the lees. He's going to lick the bottom of that barrel, even though it's the grossest, nastiest sediment, gooky stuff, filled with backwash bacteria and every other nastiness. He doesn't care because it's life. That's the point. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that loved me and alone on shore, when through scudding drifts the rainy Hyades vexed the dim sea. So, you know, this is a guy who's suffered, but also enjoyed greatly. So he's an old man, and by the time you get to old age, you will suffer and hopefully enjoy, hopefully not just suffer. I mean, if somebody goes through 80 years of life and all they've done is suffering, that is a horrible 80 years. I don't know how you can make it 80 years through pure suffering. There has to be something. There has to be some kind of enjoyment. If you don't, then you should, you know, I would imagine the people who only suffer in life die early. You can't imagine how you could not. So he's acknowledging that. He's saying all times I've enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that loved me. So he's had men around him, like the Achilles and the Agamemnons and the Menelaus's of the wars that he's fought, and with Penelope and Telemachus. And also when he's been alone. So a lot of times he's been alone, and you know, sometimes loneliness is can be a good thing, but if it's gone for too long and you don't feel connection to people anymore, that's a bad thing. And you know, then you need to open yourself up to new compatriots and new ways of meeting. And then he says, on shore and wind through scudding drifts, the rainy Hyades. Now, scudding drifts is basically just pounding showers of rain. So when you're out at sea, you know, think about if you saw Forrest Gump, or if you saw the movie 300 Rise of an Empire, there's like this, or just 300, there's this huge torrent of rain in the movie 300 that kills a lot of the men on ship in the Persian Empire with Xerxes as they are coming to the Greek Isles. And that's a scudding drift. And the rainy Hyades is basically a group of stars often associated with rain. So it's just more of that vexed the dim sea. That, you know, kind of made the dim sea crazy. Okay, let's go on to the next part. And, okay, there we go. So, I am become a name, for always with a roaming heart, with a hungry heart, for always roaming with a hungry heart. Much have I seen and known cities of men, and manners, climates, councils, governments, myself not least, but honored of them all. And drunk delight of battle with my peers, far on the ringing plains of windy Troy, I am a part of all that I have met. Let's go through this little longer section. Now, he's talking about the good times he's had out at sea. I'm become a name. I think he's saying I'm famous, right? Obviously, he's he has a name, but Ulysses, of course, is one of the most famous names in the world. To some degree, in 2018, I think more people know Odysseus than they know Achilles. I think we live in an Odyssean era that might change one day. And, you know, because throughout history, there's been eras where they've worshipped Achilles more than Odysseus. But the point is that Odysseus is one of the more famous names of all Greek, of all people. Like more people recognize that name than any of them. But he's saying, I'm become a name, so he's famous, for always roaming with a hungry heart. Much have I seen and known. So part of what makes him this famous person is that he is a roaming person, and he has a hungry heart. He has this desire for more and more and more. He has this, he wants to know more. He wants to drink life to the lees. He wants to go out and make love to different women, and he wants to meet new men and fight, you know, great warriors and overcome odds and see new worlds. Like, that's part of what he wants to roam with a hungry heart, or he has. And because of this, he's seen and known a lot. What has he seen and known? He's seen a lot of cities of men, manners, climates, counsel, different, you know, mannerisms, different ways of acting. He's seen men who are prudish versus men who are bacchanalic or pagan, and they have set orgies. And he's seen, you know, women who are covered up versus women who just walk around with their boobs hanging out, right? Like, and same thing with men. And you know, he's seen a lot of stuff in his life. He's seen a lot of different ways of existing and living. He's seen a lot of different climates. He's seen hot and cold, and he's seen men who live by the ocean and men who live out in the desert. He's seen different councils, ways of people to talk to each other and to think philosophically and politically, and different governments. Myself not least, but honored of them all. And so he's kind of gloating, I think, here. Because of his experience, and this happens in the Odyssey too, is that at one point, there's a couple points he meets some people who are telling stories of him, even though he's disguised. So he's disguised as somebody else, and then they're telling stories about the great Odysseus, which is a fun little play, I think, that they're having on. Okay, so by the way, drunk delight of battle with my peers. So he's not saying the people that he, you know, it's not like just him against Odysseus, or Achilles, although that may happen at times, or him against Ajax. He is actually talking about men who are equal to him. I think that's a powerful way of thinking about things, because you want to battle people. If you want greatness, you should want to battle people who are your peers or even better than you, because if you survive it, you'll be better. And that's true in any realm of life, not just warfare. That's true if you want to be a better writer. You should compete against people who are better than you. If you want to be a musician, if you want to be a plumber, it doesn't matter. It's basically a challenge narrative, a challenge prayer. A prayer that I want to be, you know, I was drunk with delight. Like drinking wine is what it felt like to be out battling my peers far on the ringing plains. It's ringing because their shields and their swords are clanging against each other. It's ringing on the windy plains of Troy. I am a part of all that I have met. Okay, let's go through the next. Where we go? Yet all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life. So, the interesting thing about this is, this goes back to the humanist project we've been talking about. Yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. I mean, that is one of the deepest things I've ever, there's a lot I think going on here. You know, so you think about experience as an arch where through gleams that untraveled, so you think about this arch that you travel through, that gleams like a dreamlike type of a word that gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. So the more he travels, the more the margin fades, not expands or gets smaller. The margin fades. So that means, in my view, like the margin, the thing on the side, that what I think he's trying to say, or what he is saying, is that the more he learns he doesn't know type thing. Right, the more he travels to new worlds, he sees, wow, there's other worlds I never knew existed. There's other people I never knew existed. And so his conception of the margin of what, you know, of what's possible keeps expanding or fading in it. It's just more, there's more and more when I move, forever and forever when I move. Yet all, so the more he experiences, the more he realizes there is more to experience. The more he experiences, the more he realizes there is more and more and more to experience. And he wants to, again, this is the humanist project. He wants to experience. He wants to live life to the lees. He doesn't want to, you know, here's what he does not want. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life. He doesn't want to breathe. That's not the purpose of life, he's saying. He's not saying that you should just do what it takes to survive, that that's enough. And this is one of the key questions that Wallace Stevens started off us on this journey. When he wrote Sunday Morning, the poem, the question that Wallace Stevens and all of his major poems is trying to ask is the question, does this suffice? You know, this woman is sitting here in her peignoir, her nightgown. She's eating some oranges with some coffee. She has her little cockatoo or whatever. She's looking out at the beautiful day and she's asking, is this enough? Is there more? And part of what Ulysses is doing here, or Tennyson is doing here, is that yes, it's not just experiencing the physical world. It's also having a purpose, going out in the world, experiencing new things that you would never have experienced. You know, presumably in Sunday Morning, the woman would have experienced coffee, a cuckoo, and, you know, oranges before. Although she appreciates them in a way that I think is admirable, it's not the same thing as, you know, pushing yourself beyond into the next realm of what's possible for you, even if it's thought of by you as not possible. So that, I think, is what he's saying, is breathing, you know, is just to exist. That does not suffice. Even no matter how much I can breathe and appreciate the beauty of my breath, that is not sufficient. What's sufficient is, yet all experience is an archway through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. What's great is drinking delight of battle with my peers on the ringing plains of windy Troy, of, you know, going to different places and seeing the manners, climates, consuls, and governments. That's what's news. Roaming with a hungry heart. That's what's better. I think before we get into the next one, I won't go too into this, but, you know, there's a movement among people that I read, Ryan Holiday and Tim Ferriss, of Stoic philosophy. And I think there's a real problem with Stoic philosophy. Now, there's a lot of value to how these guys are approaching this. I think it's good. Like, when a girlfriend breaks up with you, you shouldn't think, woe is me. Oh, how sad. And this, my life sucks. I don't know what to do with my life anymore. Oh my gosh, I was going to kill myself. You know, and so Stoic philosophy can help you overcome problems like that, or realize that problems like that are going to happen. But man, you know, there is an obsession and a focus in Stoicism, even in modern Stoicism, of fate. That, you know, even though they say your will, you know, the way they emphasize will is that it's this thing that allows you to overcome problems, whether that's internal or external problems. That's what will is for, is that you're going to get punched in the face. And so having a strong will is being able to get back up and move forward. There's going to be a rock in your path. So a strong will is to learn, you know, to figure out strategies to go around that rock and go to your goal or whatever. But there's not a stress on the achievement. That's not stressed in Stoicism. I've read Stoicism. That's not irrelevant, but it's not stressed. It's not focused. It's not the core of Stoicism. Stoicism is how to deal with the reality of fate as they see it. That's basically what it is. That's I think a good interpretation is that it's strategies on when shit goes wrong, which it will, and how to overcome it, how to overcome it internally and externally. And Ryan Holiday has done a good job with The Obstacles Away. Ego is the Enemy. You know, I don't like the title, of course, as an egoist, but I understand what he's trying to say, that ego can be the enemy in terms of, if you're thinking short term about things, it will lead to bad destructive ends. Okay. And he gives good strategies on how to overcome stuff like that. I like The Obstacles Away way better, because I think it, you know, gives you real strategies for when life does hit you in the head with a rock, and what you do to overcome that. When you become crippled because you got in a car accident, and how do you overcome that and strengthen your will and things of that nature? Those are good things to know. I think it's not a bad thing, but the Stoicism philosophy is a problem because it focuses on something that's not true, which is this idea that there is such a thing as fate. There is no such thing as fate. There's free will. So we have the choice to choose things. And sometimes a path, you know, there is an external world that can do things and you don't have control over that world, everything in that world. That's true. But what Stoicism does not stress, neither does Ryan Holiday really, it does not stress the role of free will, the role of having a strong will and pushing forward, you know, past whatever problems will come. It basically says you're going to get hit by the scudding hiatus, the scudding drifts of the world. And, you know, here's a strategy on how to overcome that. Whereas what's happening in this poem is Tennyson is stressing that, you know, and you'll see this more as we go, the humanist project of the strength of the will that you can develop in yourself, that you can accrue such a strong will by pursuing a purposeful passion, by pursuing what you love. He is giving up his wife, which is something that a Stoic would not usually say is good. He is giving up his duties, which a Stoic would not say is good. So basically, he has been, this character, Ulysses, has been stoical for a while in accepting his fate. But now he's saying, no, that is not enough. I need to go do what I want to do. It's for me because I love it, because travel is good. I don't want to rust unburnished. I don't want to just sit here with my old ass wife and just die and wither away when there's adventure to be had out there. I don't care if I'm 80 years old. I want to go into the waves, into my last breath, and drink life to the lees. There's not a view in Stoicism of drinking life to the lees. So here's the next section. Life piled on life. Where was it? Life piled on life, we're all too little, and of one to me, little remains. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more. I lost my place. A bringer of new things, and vile it were for some three sons. Well, let me stop there, actually. No, and vile it were for some three sons to store and hoard myself, and this gray spirit, I'm going to go all the way down here. And this gray spirit yearning and desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. Life piled on life. That's what I'm talking about with the routines of life. I mean, if any era in the history of the world has been routinized, well, that's not actually accurate. Life always becomes routined. I mean, if you're a farmer, you wake up at the crack of dawn, you know, even hundreds of years ago, you wake up at the rooster, you know, take out the eggs, you milk the cows, whatever. I've never been a farmer. But you do the things that a farmer does, and they're pretty repetitive. Now, there's some differences in terms of the seasons, for instance. That makes it somewhat different. But then in the winters, you do the same thing. In the summers, you do the same thing. I mean, if you're a rice farmer in Asia, in some place in Asia or Cambodia, you're, you know, bent over a certain way, picking rice at a very rapid pace, and it's pretty your life is homogenized in a very strong way. And that's life piled on life. And we know this feeling today. This can happen in married life. I mean, oh man, I've never been married, but I've been with people who've told me about this. And, you know, it's one of the scary things about married life, that after 5, 10, 20, 40 years, it's just life piled on life. And remember, he talked about his aged wife, and maybe they've gone through the motions enough and they're just not happy with each other. And one of the things that Christianity stresses, I think, too much, and it's the one-sidedness of Christianity that bothers me, that you have to, you know, no matter what, no matter how unhappy you are, you have to stay together and you have to, you know, dedicate your life to that one person, even if after 20 years you just don't like each other anymore or something. Like, no matter what happens. And that you are supposed to be this this unified creature now. So one of the Christian views is that you unify into one, man and wife. I see the value in that. There's definitely value and there's something there. But I think the objectivist view is that you're two people who've chosen to go on a similar path, you know, in the same direction together. And I think that's a better view because people are different. Like, it's weird to say, you know, and this is why I think there's a Christian stressing of the woman has to do what the man says, essentially. He's the boss. And that's stressed in the text of when you're reading, you know, your I do's and everything. That you're going to do what he says. And, you know, the language has been stultified a little bit in our modern age, but it's still there. And I think the view is still there. But there's a big problem with that, in my view, because it's not cogent with reality. It doesn't adhere to how things will occur over the course of a 20, 30, 40 year, 50 year marriage, if that's what you're shooting for. That two different people have two different interests, values, what else? And desires. So, you know, we talk about like the difficulty of infidelity. Okay, that's one problem. But what about when one person wants to go to Rome, another person wants to just relax this year? They don't want to go on another vacation. Like, that's a pretty big problem, right? You know, what about when one person wants to quit their job, but the other person wants to get a promotion, wants them to get a promotion so they can get a new house? Like, that's a fundamental problem. That's huge. So, you know, sex is only one big issue of, you know, only having sex with one person when you're going to desire to have sex with other people. That is unequivocally a fact of, you know, unless you have no libido at all, you're going to want to have sex with other people. I mean, after having sex with the same person for 10 years, it is scientifically proven 100% that desire for a particular person does not match the length of a marriage. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't get married, but it's just a reality that you're going to sexually be attracted to other people after you've slept with the same person for 10,000 times, right? So that's kind of a view of life piled on life, is having sex with the same person, you know, day in and day out. It sounds wonderful the first 5,000 times, but then it's like, well, it's getting old. And a lot of married couples express this kind of view. And this is a big, you know, issue of married people, is like, it just becomes, sex becomes routinized. You know, it's Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Okay, let's have sex. All right. It's Wednesday at 6:02. Okay, we're done. Let's go back to work. Right. Like, what? That's not a fun way of, you know, that's life piled on life, as though to breathe were life. That's not a good thing. Life piled on life, we're all too little, and of one to me, little remains. So he's saying, you know, I've had this routinized thing, 6 o'clock. Okay, let's go. Okay, 6:02. We're done. 6 o'clock. Okay, let's go. Okay, 6:02. We're done. He's had that for so long now. It's too little, and only a little bit remains. And what does he mean by that? A little bit of his life. He's in the lees. Life, you know, live life to the lees. Oof, you don't know. I ain't just going to do that no more. I don't care if it hurts your feelings. There's no afterlife. There is something more to this life that we can have. Maybe we can do it together. Maybe we can explore sexuality together, but only a little bit remains to me. We gotta seize the life that we have. And he stresses this in the next part. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence. Every hour is saved from it. So I may have 20,000 hours left. So every hour that I live, not life piled on life, but lived, is an hour that I'm not dead yet. And it's saved from that eternal silence, something more, a bringer of new things. So every hour gets him closer to something new, a new experience, a new person to meet, a new manner, a new government to interact with, a new, you know, man to fight on the ringing plains of Troy. Okay. By the way, a bringer of new things in Violet were for some three sons. Excuse me. Three sons to store and hoard myself, you know, hoarding like a hoarder. He's just hoarding himself by his still hearth, his fireplace with his aged wife. Three sons isn't 3 days. I think it really means 3 years. So he's been doing this for 3 years. And some that long, but that's actually a powerful thing to me, that this isn't like a 40-year thing he's been doing. This is 3 years. And he's like, that's enough. This is enough of this. I've been doing this for 3 friggin' years. This is a man who wants to live. And I think that's great art, by the way, that he's not saying, you know, I've been, you know, doing this thing, the song and dance for 25 years and now, which is overdoing it. Excuse me. He's saying it's 3 years, and he puts it in terms of three sons. And I don't think he means 3 days. I think he means 3 years. Okay. And this last line. And this great spirit, yearning and desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. So knowledge is a sinking star. And he's going to, and this gray spirit yearning and desire. So he's calling himself a gray spirit because he's old. His spirit is not the youthful rose red that it was when he was 25 years old, fighting on the plains of Troy and the ringing plains of Troy right next to Achilles and Agamemnon. Instead, this gray spirit, but it still yearns and desire. What does it desire? To follow knowledge like a sinking star. So even if there's less and less knowledge or it's a sinking star, he doesn't care. He wants to go beyond the utmost of human thought. Wherever human thought is, he wants to expand it. That's part of his mission. Okay, now he's going to switch to talking about his son. So this is my son, mine own Telemachus, to whom I leave the scepter and the isle. Well loved of me, discerning to fulfill this labor by slow prudence, to make mild a rugged people, and through soft degrees subdue them to the useful and the good. So he's now, it's like he's talking to himself. We don't know who he is talking to yet, really, although we have some ideas. He is talking to somebody, it seems. And he's saying, you know, this is my son, my own Telemachus. I'm going to leave the scepter and the isle. I'm going to leave the crown of my government. He's going to be the king now. I'm going to leave this whole place to him. He's well loved of me. I love the guy, you know, discerning to fulfill this labor. I believe he can do this better than I can. By slow prudence, you know, by slow thoughtfulness, he can make mild a rugged people. Remember those savage beasts, the savage people who know not me? Well, that's because Ulysses is not the greatest king, perhaps. He's an adventurer. He's not a king. And he recognizes that. And there's a slow prudence that you need to take into consideration when you're meeting out and doling unequal laws to a savage race. And these rugged people, these tough men who are breaking rocks and, excuse me, you know, and they're out, you know, herding cattle and growing crops. They're tough and they're rugged, and you have to deal with them in a certain way. And you have to do it through soft degrees, subdue them to the useful and the good, you know, to a unified building a better civilization, which is what we're trying to do in this project. Okay. Most blameless is he, Telemachus. Centered in the sphere of common duties, decent not to fail. In offices of tenderness and pay, meet adoration to my household gods when I am gone. He works his work, I mine. I think he's just going more on the qualifications of Telemachus. And meet here, I think, is, mainly means appropriate or suitable. So he's saying that, hey, this, you know, it's not his fault that he's not an adventurer like me. It's not his fault that he's a great king. Like, he is who he is. He works his work, I mine. And I really like this. Like, there's this view that we have to be these great adventurers and that it's bad to be a business person. Or if you're a writer, you have to also be a great warrior and you have to fly to the moon or you have nothing to write about. And, you know, there's this idea that if you're a writer, you write. If you're a fighter, you fight. If you're a warrior, you go to war. If you're, a plumber, you plumb. If you're whatever it is, you're a craftsman, you craft, right? If you're a teacher, you teach. Whatever it is, you do it. And he's not blamed. Ulysses is not blaming his son Telemachus because he is centered in the sphere of common duties, that he's doing the common thing. Ulysses is not condemning him that. Telemachus is doing the good offices of tenderness, and he's going to meet or be, you know, do the appropriate things to the household gods. He's going to treat the household gods that they worship appropriately, sacrifice correctly so that their civilization can continue and flourish when Ulysses is gone. He does what he does. He knows how to sacrifice properly so we can have a good crop. I do what I do. I'm going to go out beyond the utmost bound of human thought. That's the difference. Is Telemachus meets is appropriate to the household gods, so he does the right sacrifices so that the civilization can grow, which is a good thing. But I, Ulysses, go beyond the utmost bound of human thought. So this is like, know thyself. You know who you are. Okay. All right. Here's the next section. So now he's switching from Telemachus and he's saying there, right? Now he's switching from his son. He's saying, there lies the port. The vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark broad seas. My mariners, souls that have toiled and wrought and thought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine and opposed free hearts, free foreheads. You and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. So we've switched to the port. Their gloom, he's not saying their glooms. He's saying their gloom, the dark broad seas, like over there. And it basically means the dark broad seas, you know, it's scowling at us. Their gloom, the dark broad seas, the scowling, scary seas. And then he says about my mariners, because he's the leader. My mariners, souls that have toiled and wrought and fought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took. So, they have fought battles. They have, encountered dangers, and they did it with a frolic welcome. Like a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine. So even the thunder that came at them, Zeus fought them. Sunshine came and they made love on beautiful lands. But they opposed the bad with free hearts and free foreheads. And opposed free hearts, free foreheads. You know, this is a good example of enjambment. Like the line, you have to take that together. And opposed free hearts, free foreheads. What do they oppose? The thunder and the sunshine. You know, that is an interesting line, I think. They opposed the thunder and the sunshine. The sunshine is the easy way, I think. They never took the easy way. The easy way in the Odyssey would have been to stay with Circe, or to stay with the sirens and just kind of make love to them all the time. And just, well, I think the sirens would have led to their death. But like, you know, with Cersei, the idea, that would be one of the ideas. So just stay in that state of calm, easy life. Now we get a kind of sense of he's talking to somebody. Who the heck is he talking about? To some other old man. Maybe it's his companion that he's traveled with. What was that? Okay, you and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all. With many, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. Where's that? One second. Well, we'll stop there. So not only did they, these men, when they were young, he's saying you and I are old, and I think he's referring to some, I assume some kind of other mariner that he's talking to, but you and I are old, old age hath yet his honor and his toil, death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. So they strove with gods when they were younger, and Ulysses, this is somewhat literal, as they fought against Aphrodite and Ares, the god of war, the god of love, goddess of love, and Athena, the goddess of war and battle and such. And they fought these people, but they also fought against them. They fought with them, against them, and they fought against other men who were like gods. I mean, in their youth, they were strong. And we all have the sense that you get older that in your youth, you were strong and powerful. He can do great things despite his knowledge of death. So he's you know, but something ere the end, death closes all. And he's saying old age hath yet his honor and his toil. So there's something that you could still do as an old man. Your life's not over, even though death closes all. And death is the mother of beauty, remember. But something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. Okay. The light twinkles from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. So, you know, the twinkling light, I think, is the idea here is, in my view, he's talking about, you know, when you're out at sea, the stars twinkling from the rocks on shore or something. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. You know, this is kind of a metaphor for your life. Your life is a day and it's waning. It's at the end. You're at the dusk. The slow moon climbs. So the night is coming. And the deep, I think he's talking about the ocean as the deep, you know, the deep blue ocean. The deep moans round with many voices. So the ocean has taken many friends and lives and voices, and it moans with it because there's, if you think about like all the people, if they were all to moan and the, I don't want to be dead anymore. Like that's what the deep is. And there's a metaphorical sense of the deep as this part of life that is gone, that is, you know, no longer there. Come, my friends. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. So Ulysses now is addressing his friends. So my take is that as he's addressing new people, you know, you and I are old and come my friends. I think he's talking to other mariners who are also old and he's convincing them. This is how I take it. But I think on another layer, he's talking to you and he's talking as Ulysses, as this fiction hero. So there's two levels of this. There's the actual interpretation of this of, you know, let's say there's pretend there's an actual Ulysses, you know, in ancient times at the end of his life, you know, in the world of the Iliad, you know, he's in that, the world of the Iliad, the Homer's world, he's in the end of that arc that Homer never wrote about. And Tennyson is kind of adding to the spirit of this person. But on another layer, I think Tennyson is trying to say something about what the literary world has to tell us in 2018. And I mean, to the, like you watching this right now, what he has to say. Oh, gee, something fell. Anyway, you know what he has to say to you in 2018. So, you know, there's two different layers to that. There's two different layers to what I think he's saying in this poem about Ulysses actually thinking as a human, you know, in 700 BCE in Homer's world, or really like 1500, like 1300 BCE when Homer's writing about this world, like the real Ulysses. So there's that version. And then there's the version of the literary Ulysses that you can read. You know, you can't see it up here, but I have a bookshelf. I should have brought it, of the actual Odyssey and the Iliad. And when you read that, this is what Ulysses would say after you read that in like about life. He's saying, you know, Ulysses as an old man from that book right up there, as he's reading to Kirk Barbera, he's saying, "Come, Kirk, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose, Achilles, or Odysseus, the Ulysses, the literary character, holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die." And if you take it as a literary sense, then, you know, there's a sense where he's never going to die as a person until Kirk dies, right? Or until the human race dies. And, you know, now that's just my layer that I think. I don't know if anybody's ever said that. That's how I take part of this, is that there's an element that this is a literary character, and Tennyson knows that. And so he's playing on the reality of this historical figure and the literature of, you know, reading that. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. So when you go out into the world, you could die. You know, if Kirk goes out and fights some new battle, I could maybe really die in real life physically, or I can possibly metaphorically lose and fail. You know, it may be that the gulfs will wash us down. And maybe we shall touch the happy isles, and, you know, which is like heaven in a sense, and see the great Achilles whom we knew. So, you know, you can strive with gods yourself. I think it's a very inspirational thing that he's trying to tell us here. Okay. Let's read this last section. "Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Abides here means remains, basically. So what remains, you know, much remains. So much is taken, but much remains. Even if you're 85, you have like 2 years to live, a year to live, and that's it. Okay. So much remains. It doesn't matter. It's okay. And you're not the strong person that you were when you were 25, 35, 40 years old, now that you're in your 50s or 60s, let's say. Or even if you're 35 and you're not what you were when you're 22, right? It's okay. You're not that strong, but you're not as strong as the person who moved earth and heaven to get what you wanted. But that what you are. Accept who you are. One equal temper. So you have a temper of heroic heart, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will. And this is a poem about will and about the spirit of the human, the strength of the human spirit. We are strong because of our own will to strive. That strength, you know, we tend to think of strength merely as physical strength, but there's another element to strength, and that is the strength of will, not to, you know, evoke anything evil, but there is something of the strength of our ability to move on beyond the power of our bodies, you know, and we all have a sense, I think, of that there is a limit that our bodies have, but our will, mind over matter type idea, can push past that. So that's the poem by Ulysses. And, you know, I hope you enjoyed that converse with verses. There's a lot there, but to wrap up, I wanted to, you know, point out the similarities between, you know, again, the kind of reemphasize what's going on with all of these poems, that this is a humanist project to find values on this earth that can help us enjoy life as it actually is, rather than as we would like it. And that is an important message that I think we don't get as much anymore. And so if you want to have an affirmation and you want it to be the Lord's Prayer, then have it be the Lord's Prayer. But add a few poems to it. Poems for People Who Hate Poetry is about adding different types of poems to your repertoire so that you can understand the world in a different way. It doesn't have to just be a Christian view or a Muslim view or a traditional religious view or even a New Age religious view. There's so many different options. This is I've chosen four humanist viewpoints on having no faith, but still getting at that spiritual spunk that we all need in life to push ourselves beyond the sounding furrows through the scudding drifts in the Hyades. You know, that's what we need, is we need that kind of affirmation. We need that kind of spiritual push. And I hope that you found that interesting and that you put on your wall, as I do, poetry, even one or two favorite poems that you might have. I think that's something we need more of, these powerful poems to affirm and to read them out loud on a regular basis so that we can find other people who we can connect with on the basis of those values, so that we can rise them up psychologically into the deep ingraining in our soul of what they mean to us. And it can help guide our lives as the Lord's prayers guide, for better or worse, the lives of Christians. Thank you. And I'll see you on Poems for People Who Hate Poetry next time.